This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
The German war is therefore at an end. We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing. Today is Victory in Europe Day.
The voice of Winston Churchill 75 years ago, setting off celebrations throughout the UK and especially in London, where many Americans reveled in the news of victory in places like Trafalgar Square. I remember a decorated P-47 pilot named John Wiener telling me that's where he was, and May 8th, 1945 happened to be his 23rd birthday. That's quite a birthday party. Richard Christensen had been wounded 6 weeks earlier while serving with the 94th Infantry Division.
I was hit up in the left arm, and it took out the tricep.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't by the measure of some wounds. It wasn't really a great wound, but along the way, I got sent back to Paris and then from there back to England. And I think all of that came because of infection. And it took quite a while to, they did some more surgery when I got back to England.
What was that like to be in the hospital and hear, this is over, the Allies have won?
Actually, it was a wonderful experience. First of all, I was in a hospital on Easter that year also. And then the Germans capitulated, and that really was, that was a wonderful feeling. I was at that time able to get around pretty good, and I had met some English people, and it was really wonderful. The first Whitsuntide holiday was right after that. Whitsuntide is, as church people know, Pentecost.
Mm-hmm.
And the English people had not had any days off, any kind of celebrated days, since 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was away on that weekend, and that was really quite an experience to see how happy they were, how much they enjoyed a new kind of freedom. One of the interesting things about my getting out of the hospital, they gave me food stamps for the 10 days leave that I had, and I went to visit a relative of one of my uncles was from England, and I went to see his sister, and I gave her all those stamps for food.
Mm-hmm.
And she came home the next day and put everything on one plate. She said, that's 10 days worth of stamps.
Wow.
And the English had been going through that since 1939. They were a brave and good people.
Another Purple Heart recipient in London that day was Duke O'Donnell, a B-17 bombardier with the 303rd Bomb Group.
Well, I was on leave that day. I was in London. We used to get 2 days leave a month. And then we heard that we get 2 extra days because the war is over. So I was in London, somebody said Churchill's going to come out of that building over there. So I stuck around and for a while and didn't come out. But Monty came out. I saw him, Field Marshal Montgomery, head of the English Army. So, but I never did see Churchill come out.
But that had to be a pretty neat place to be, because London had been bombed so much throughout this war, and now victory is won. I bet there are a lot of excited people around.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And London was a real desolate place, almost, parts of it. There would be like blocks after blocks leveled, just nothing but rubble. They take maybe 8 or 9 blocks and take all the rubble off and pile them up in one block, make a huge pyramid of just old stone and the remains of buildings, rubble, really something to see.
So now that the war is over, I bet you wanted to come home.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, at first we thought we'd be going to the Pacific, because the war in the Pacific was still going on. So we went to Liverpool and got in a cement boat. When I say cement boat, I don't mean they carried cement. It was made out of cement. There were a few like that. And so we left Liverpool for Boston, and we got out about halfway across the ocean, the war in the Pacific ended. So it took 13 days to come because we broke down, I guess, about half one day and drifted backwards toward England. That's how I got it. And then they ran out of food at the end, too. But we did, by that time, we didn't care because the last day, all we had to eat was ice cream.
That 20-year-old was just thankful he could eat anything and see anything after what had happened to him 5 months earlier on New Year's Eve.
Well, we went to briefing, of course, which is first before the mission, find out about the target and any defenses they might have down there, how many guns, if they know how many guns they have. Anyway, so then we took off, got flown toward the target, and started seeing flak. And they had three types of ways to shoot flak: straight at the plane, or what they call tracking flak, which is the most accurate. They shoot ahead of you, and on the bomberman you can't deviate from course, so you have to fly right into it. And that was the case in this case. I looked up, and they had either four-gun batteries or six-gun batteries. And up ahead, I saw one shell go off, and then another one closer, and another one closer. And I knew they had at least four, and I knew we were going to be right there when I got hit. So I even said over the intercom, we're going to get hit. And the next thing I knew, I thought my head was gone. The top of my head was gone. I just sat there, waiting to die. didn't bother me a bit. And I thought, well, maybe I'm not going to die right away. I can get these bombs out. So I told Mac, I said, tell me when the other ships dropped their bombs. So I was able to feel around. I couldn't see because I had glass in my eye. And he said, there they go. So I felt the toggle switch, which you can get the bombs out that way. And so I got them out that way. And then I was really out of my head for the rest of the day, maybe ever since, I don't know. But anyway, so Max says, go back to the radio room. So I couldn't see, so I got up, and the top turret gunner, the engineer, helped me along. And I thought to myself, I'll jump out of the plane to make it lighter, they can get back to England easier. If I lighten the load up a little bit, you see how I was out of my head. So the engineer, DeWillers, took my parachute off. It was a chest pack, so I could get through the narrow catwalk to the radio room. And but I did have sense enough not to jump out without a parachute. Huh? So anyway, I was going to jump out through the bomb bay doors, but anyway. So we went back to the radio room, and then we had to make a forced landing.
I didn't want to interrupt you because I wanted to hear the story from your perspective as you remember it. But people listening are saying, boy, this guy is describing this like it's no big deal. But the first thing you said was all of a sudden, after you saw, you know, one piece of flak closer, another burst closer, you told everyone we're going to get hit. The next thing you know, you thought the top of your head was blown off. So this flak exploded right in the nose of the plane, knocked out the plexiglass, knocked it into your eyes, and you're blind, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, that's right. No, couldn't see. The plexiglass, of course, that all crumbled, you know, breaks up in little pieces. I have my face, my eye, and my nose.
So it's basically like buckshot going into your face, only plexiglass.
Yeah, right, that's about it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't see. You're feeling your face. You probably feel a lot of blood, and you really thought that half your head was blown off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
But you stayed at your position to drop your bombs. And this is what your pilot, Bill McLeod, told me was so impressive that inspired the rest of your crew. They all wanted to take you back and give you medical attention. You said, no, I want to drop these bombs. But you're saying that wasn't necessarily a conscious thought, that you were pretty out of it.
You get so trained, I think, to it that dropping the bombs is the one thing you're thinking about. So you don't want to change your mind. You just want to get the bombs out and then figure out what, like I say, I wasn't too sensible either.
Did you ever find out how many pieces of plexiglass they pulled out of you?
No, I don't know. There were quite. There's still one in my nose, but it doesn't bother me any. And so I don't know how many they. No, they probably threw them away. I don't know.
So the one that's still in your nose, you can feel it internally, or you can rub your finger over it and feel it?
I can feel it right. I'm feeling it right now. Yeah, it's up in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right inside of your left eye, there's a little spot on the bridge of your nose.
Right in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So at the time, you're still there in the bombardier position in the nose. Of course, the glass is shot out. Not that you could see it anyway. You're completely blind, and you needed help from your crew in order to know when to flip that switch and drop the bomb. So how did that work?
Well, I called Mac, the pilot, and said, tell me when the other ships dropped their bombs, because we were in formation. So when the other ones dropped their bombs, I was able to find this, what they call a toggle switch, and got them out that way.
You're just 19 years old at the time. You knew this was dangerous work before you got into it. In your heart of hearts, did you think you'd be coming home? Did you think you were going to see America again?
No, I tell you, the first few weeks there, we were losing planes. Well, we were losing like at least one plane a mission. We had to fly 35 missions, and we put up 39 planes. So I figured, well, my chances of getting back are 4 out of 39. They aren't very good. So I didn't think I was going to make it. I thought it's only a matter of days or weeks or months at the most, and I'm done for. So I didn't think I was going to get back, but I did.
Duke O'Donnell, one of the many Americans celebrating VE Day in London 75 years ago. Another was George Eldridge, also a bombardier, but on B-26s with the 344th Bomb Group. When I asked him what his most difficult moment of the war was, he didn't zero in on any of the close calls he survived, but on a situation that challenged him in a different way.
Probably the one when we went out to Rouen on the Rhine River. And did nothing because one of the airplanes on the way back went down, and only one man bailed out of it. You just have to pack up their things, all of their belongings, and write letters to their family. The squadron commander has to do it, and all the crew members also had to do it if it was your crew member. And then in the case of many of your friends, you helped send letters back to the family.
That's something you had to do personally?
Oh, yes. And it had to have been handwritten. They couldn't be typed. I was in Belgium, but the squadron commander had left some things when we moved from England over to Belgium. He made arrangements that somebody would pick him up. And he said, because I was so close to coming home, and the war was just so close to over, he said, you're going to pick up this stuff, and you got a C-47. And we were back at Stansted, so naturally I went to London. I was there in May of 45. You can't imagine how many glasses were broken and thrown out on the streets. Glass on the streets was just solid. I don't know how anybody walked on there. Nobody was barefoot, I'll tell you that. GIs with their girlfriends, or with any girl they could find, hanging out of every window on both sides of the streets all across London. And the British soldiers and airmen, they really got drunk.
Victory in Europe meant a turning of the tide. Servicemen and civilians could start to pick up the pieces. You heard George Eldridge talk about airmen who never came back from their missions. One of the efforts that began in earnest after VE Day was the quest to recover some of their remains. That would be one of the duties of Vito Mastrangelo, who had been tasked with burying the fallen since he landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day.
Was that a relief for you to hear that the war was over?
Yes, very much so.
I bet.
And so we had nothing to do for a while till new orders came in. My order was, take a few men with you. I want you to stop to every little village in Germany. There was no road. You had to take down a fence, drive through, hook up the fence to find the mayor. He might be out there cutting wheat with the scythe. The words to him with my Kistner, the German interpreter, were any air crews killed in your vicinity? And he would say yes or no. If it was yes, where are they buried? He would take us to the German cemetery. They were generally buried at a corner of the cemetery. So we would mark how many. They would say, well, they had 55. So we make records of it. A few days later, the digging crews came behind us and picked them up. And we did that until about November. That's all we did.
So for 6 months, you're going around to every little town.
Every little village, yeah.
And if you guys weren't doing this,
they would still be there.
And no one would know where they were.
That's right.
Because if you didn't have that immediate knowledge of the person there then,
yes,
there'd be, it would be needle in a haystack.
Yeah, you wouldn't know at all.
So that work for 6 months,
yeah,
I bet it's still as morbid as this whole thing is. That probably has to be satisfying knowing what you did for all those families.
That's right.
It's time for another break, but when we come back, another D-Day survivor on how he experienced the bookend to those 11 intense months on the European continent, as well as veterans who experienced May 8th, 1945 in different settings. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.